everyone. My very special guest today is writer, director, John Oak Dalton. John, how are you?
How are you tonight, Scott?
Good. I want to say thank you for coming on to the show.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
No problem. The first one I want to talk to you about, I'm not going to go the whole way back. I'm going to go up a little bit. Mental Scars in 2009.
Wow.
I've not seen it. But which Mental Scars? Now, where did this idea come from when you wrote it?
Wow, that is throwing it back. And I actually hadn't seen that one until pretty recently. It was on streaming, and I finally, I actually hadn't seen it and caught up to it. It's probably actually the most expensive film I've ever worked on. I mean, it was a pretty big budget film with a few name actors in it. I was actually brought into it by the original director, a man named Ivan Rogers, who is sort of how I broke into the industry to begin with. But I came in and did some rewrites over that script. So that wasn't really one that was my original idea. I came in and rewrote over two other guys who were working on the script for it. And it, it was a big budget movie, and it has kind of made its rounds. It came out quite a long time ago, so it's finally hit streaming. But that was kind of an elusive one for me to watch because I didn't own a copy of it for a long time. So, yeah, I came in and did a rewrite over that all the way up into production. I think I did 8 or 10 drafts over it. Even when they were shooting and some things had to change on the fly, I worked on it. Even when they shot some in Indiana, and I think a lot of it, like the junkyard scenes and things like that, I believe they were shot maybe in the Carolinas or Georgia or something like that. So, yeah, that's one I don't hear much about or get asked about very much. But, yeah, that one's out there.
Well, okay. I guess I kind of shocked you on that one.
Yeah, I don't think anyone's ever asked me about it.
Yeah, I'm a film buff, and like I told you, I don't care. I said before, I started this podcast back in 2010 under the mindset of promoting and reviewing, no budget films, low budget films. And because I'm in the industry already, as far as an actor wise, I'm behind the scenes. So I understand that it's not easy. People who criticize films for lighting or for this and that, they have no idea what it's like to be in that situation of trying to make a film. And, making a film and completing it is a goal itself. I mean, I know a lot of films that might start filming in 2012 and don't get finished until 2023.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
It's
all about life and money.
It's interesting that you say that, because I think there's this sentiment that, people have said to me, actually, things like, well, if I don't get a chance to make, Schindler's List Part 2 or whatever, I'm going to bang out a bunch of horror movies and whatever. But, it's just as hard to make. I mean, making any movie is hard. Any kind of movie is hard. It's not that making genre movies is easier. The craft isn't any different. And I think that's something people don't understand. And I think there is I think especially in the horror movie community, which I probably know the best, fans are pretty loyal, which is a great thing. They will follow you to the ends of the earth. They will follow you, what you're doing, but they can also smell a rat. So if you're getting into horror movies because you think there's an easy entryway there, you're not going to be very successful. If you're a true fan, genre fan, people will follow you, and they aren't going to split hairs on some of the details. So that's a good observation.
Well said. So here's one for you. Haunted House on Sorority Road.
Hey, man, I got to be ready for everything tonight. Okay. So how do I talk about this movie? So I was sort of out of the movie business. A good friend of mine, John Polonia, half of the Polonia brothers, he had passed away suddenly. And my friend Ivan Rogers that I spoke of, he passed away. And I was just kind of, there were two people I came up with in the industry. And so I kind of I was kind of feeling like walking away. I'd also changed careers. I'd worked in mostly television for about 20 years, which is why I'm very fast as a movie maker, learning from television. But I moved more into the marketing field, and I thought, well, I really need to focus on that. And there were a lot of reasons I'd walked away. I had met this young filmmaker who was in high school at the time. His name was Enrique Couto in the Dayton, Ohio area, which is about an hour east of me here in Indiana. And so maybe 90 minutes. And so, I had met him at a horror convention, which I always say, if you want to break in, go to a couple horror conventions and just meet people, you know, start walking around. People start to know who you are. So I had met him, and he had convinced me to stay and watch one of his movies. He was like a high school kid, and I was an adult man at the time, but he was just a compelling person. He's a very charismatic young person. So flash forward a few years, and I was judging a film festival for high school students in Richmond, Indiana, where I work. And we needed a speaker, and they said, or I'd said, well, I remember this guy I met a few years ago, Enrique Couto, who was a high school kid, and he might be a good speaker. And so I reached out to him on Facebook, I think, and he came over and gave a really good talk. And afterwards, we kind of got to talking about movie making. And I said, I'm kind of out of the business, you know, I'm kind of burned out on it, but he was working on this movie. He sent me his movie Babysitter Massacre. And I thought, there's just a lot of just this anarchy and energy to it. I really liked it. And then, he reached out and said, I think that's really the one that he kind of broke through on as a filmmaker. But then, he said, I'm going to make this movie called Haunted House on Sorority Row, which, you know, everything's in the title. The only superfluous word is really on, right? Horror, you know, Haunted House and Sorority Row. Yeah. That's what it is. And I thought, well, that sounds like a lot of fun. And he had a poster already, too. And, you know, a lot of times in the B-movie world, sometimes there's a premise and a poster, you know, before there's ever a movie. And, you know, he talked to me about it. And I really thought hard about it. And so I was sitting home one night with my daughter and my wife and kind of talking about it. And my wife and daughter were listening. And then my daughter said, well, you're not going to do one of these movies with like a bunch of pillow fights and shower scenes. And I was like, well, actually that's exactly what I was going to do. But then I was like, oh no, I would never do anything. I would never do anything like that. No, it's going to be a feminist horror film. So that's why I ended up writing. Cause my daughter called me on my BS right at the jump. It's been reviewed very positively, and I'm really very proud of it because I kind of came back into the industry with it, and it did pretty well, and I think it helped Enrique's career, and it definitely helped my career to come back and do that film. And that was probably, I think I kind of walked away in about 2009 when all that happened. Yeah. This was probably 13, 14 that I came back to and did this film and one for Mark called Jurassic Prey. Those were the two movies that kind of brought me back into the business and that I've been going again. So that's a fond memory. That's one of my favorites that I wrote for somebody. I think that movie turned out really good.
Well, that's awesome because the next one's the same year. And it's the Scare Waves in 2014.
Yeah. I ended up knocking out about five projects probably in a row with Enrique. Scare Waves was an anthology that he was working on. And I have a segment in that along with two other writers. My kind of log line for is it starts Double Indemnity and ends Dawn of the Dead, kind of. I love film noir, and it kind of starts with he had the premises for all of them, and then we just kind of went with them. And mine was about a pair of hard luck robbers, and there's kind of a femme fatale character. And that's kind of what I riffed on. My touch points for writing, it's interesting working with someone like Enrique, who's a young person. He's 20 years younger than me. And his touch points are 80s, 90s films. My touch points are 60s, 70s. You know, we're just a different. So it's interesting to see us blending our styles. You know, I love film noir. I love Italian neorealism. I love French New Wave, you know, Japanese rubber monster movies of the 60s. I love, you know, Eastern European, you know, Soviet science fiction movies of the 70s. So, you know, those are my touch points. And his are, you know, working with somebody his age, you know, it's more, you know, franchise movies of 80s and 90s, you know, so it's interesting to blend our styles together. And I have a cool segment in that. That's a neat little movie.
Nice. How about the Amityville Death House in 2015?
Oh man, Amityville Death House. Man, this is really, we're all okay. So Amityville Death House. Well, I'm now 6 degrees from Eric Roberts, right? Because he has a voiceover in it. So everybody that has something to do with Eric Roberts. So that one, the producer on that's Fred Olin Ray, who's very, very, very prolific. Let me say this. I'm kind of to the point in my life where I've probably sold, I'm not exactly sure, maybe about 60 screenplays. And about a third of those, 20 some, have been turned into movies, and the rest have died on the vine the way projects do, you know. So right. If I do something now, there kind of has to be a reason for me to do it, like something I'm interested in or some challenge, not just to write for people, because I've already done that. So yeah. I think the big draw for that was Fred Olin Ray was the producer. He's incredibly prolific. He's an incredibly prolific producer. And I wanted to kind of tangentially work with him. I never communicated with him directly. But tangentially, I got to be involved in one of his films as a producer. It was directed by Mark Polonia, but Fred Olin Ray produced it. And, you know, I was involved in some of the email exchanges, even though, like, for rewrites, he didn't write to me directly. He would write to Mark. And then Mark would send his very uncensored remarks right to me. He did not pull any punches. But Fred Olin Ray is of the old school, you know, where this is just how he is. So that was a fun one. It actually turned out, I think, pretty good because there was some money behind it. And, you know, Fred, I know, put a little work in on the post to sort of spruce it up. So it turned out well. Not all of my script is there. You know, that was an occasion where kind of in the post, they wrote some narration that was Eric Roberts doing the narration. And I think to sort of tie some of the pieces together, I write, you know, to be fair to Fred and to Mark, I'm a pretty esoteric Baroque, you know, B-A-R-O-Q-U-E Baroque writer. And I think they wanted it to be a little simpler. So there is some narration that ties it together that isn't attached to me, but yeah, I'm proud of that one. It turned out really well.
Cool. Now we're going back to Henrique, Alone in the Ghost House in 2015.
Okay. This is a movie I did that was a found footage. So it was really different for me. I wrote about a 30-page, probably like a 30-page treatment with some scenes kind of written. It was almost like a short story. It wasn't really a script. And it was shot super loose, where there was a lot of improv. It turned out pretty cool, I think. Found footage, I think there's still an audience for it if it's done well. And I think this one turned out pretty well. You know, we went round and round about the ending, and I think they just sort of improvised a slightly different ending than what I put in there. But it was the first movie that I had really seen Iabu Windermere in, who stars in my new movie, Smart House. So I thought she really steals the show in that, as does Aaron Ryan, who plays a kind of like a TV fortune teller that's trying to, you know, that's part of the found footage part. And she starred in my Girl in the Crawl Space movie. So I consider that one the one where I also Joni Durian is in that, who's in my first movie, and John Hambrick, who's in my movies. That's where I started to see their performances and some of their standout performances with improv and so on. So, you know, when I got around to making my own movie and shooting Girl in the Crawl Space in 18, I drew on a lot of those people, and it really started with seeing them in Alone in the Ghost House. They did a really nice, nice, talented group of people that Enrique put together over there in Dayton.
That's awesome. Now, The next one you mentioned earlier, Jurassic Prey.
Okay. So Jurassic Prey. So Mark Polonia and I, we have a lot in common, actually. We both work at small colleges. You know, we both have background in television, about the same age. Both have kids, grandkids, you know, the whole thing. And, you know, Mark is the first person that ever really turned one of my scripts into a movie. I had sold scripts before Mark, but they had not been made. Mark is the first person that turned a script I wrote, which was called Among Us, a Bigfoot movie, into a real movie. And so he and I are always, you know, I'm always going to be up for whatever he wants to do because he gave me my first break, my first real break. So again, the same time period that I was working on Haunted House and Sorority Row, Mark had reached out, and I was kind of, you know, he had kind of soldiered on after his brother passed away, and he made some films, and he was still wanting them. I've probably written that have come out 8 or 10 for him, and probably another 8 or 10 that haven't gotten made. And that was one where he said, "Hey, I just want to do this 50s rubber monster thing, kind of like Beast from Haunted Cave, or, you know, or 1,000 Fathoms or something. I want to do something like that, kind of a mix of noir and, you know, and monster movie. I'm going to use a rubber stop animated monster and some puppets." I was like, "That sounds perfect." So I had a lot of fun writing that. It's actually one of my favorite ones, favorite scripts. You know, some of it looks cheaper, you know, the way it turned out. I actually think it's fun. I think a lot of people didn't get the joke. You know what I mean? It was supposed to be fun. It was like a 50s monster movie. It has stop animation in it. You know, it came out in the late 2000s, but it, you know, and I think people didn't really understand, you know, what we were trying to do. But I'm proud of it. I'm proud of, you know, the script. And if I was to rank, you know, my top couple movies that I wrote for other people, not the ones I directed, but the ones I wrote for other people, I would rank that one of my favorite ones.
Well, the problem with people, people, they don't understand the independent circuit to begin with. So they also don't understand either that if you ain't got much of a budget on a film, you can't make it serious, because if you do, it's going to look stupid. So you got to make it funny.
Yeah, I think all my scripts are really funny. I don't think other people think that. I think they're funny. I don't think I've really made too many serious movies. I think most of my movies are funny, but
goofy films. I do. It's a film that you can put on a Friday night, lights off, drinking some beer, and just laugh your ass off. You know, yeah.
I think serious the other critic. Thing that people don't understand is, I mean, by and large, at least the people I've worked with, you're not trying to make something bad. You are trying to make something fun, maybe, but not intentionally. I mean, nobody wants to say, I've never been on a set where actors are not trying, you know, they don't want to be called ugly. You know, people have said people, you know, movies I've worked on were ugly or they can't act, or, you know, or they were phoning things. People don't phone it. I mean, I think anybody that works in our part of the industry, B movies or even lower than B movies, you're always thinking X will lead to Y will lead to Z, right? If I do this, then maybe I'll get a break in that, and then this will turn into their net. So I don't care who you are, at least the movies I've been involved with, writing or helping as a PA or directing my own movies, people don't want it to be bad. Sometimes they turn out bad. You know, sometimes they do anyway. You don't know. But people don't intentionally, the people that I've worked with, they're not trying to make a bad movie. They may be trying to make something you can have fun with, but they're not intentionally trying to make it bad, because everybody that's in it, above the line and below the line, they think it will lead to something else. And so you're not intentionally trying to be, you know, look ugly, act stupid, you know, cut to, I mean, sometimes you have to cut corners, but you're not doing it to make it bad. You're doing it because you have to cut the corners. And I've done that in my own movie. So
it's a project alone just to make a movie. You know what I mean?
And that's what people don't get. It's so hard. Like, I've told people when they want to make a movie, it has to be something you want to live with for a year. And they're like, a year? I'm like, yeah, by the time you shoot, or by the time the night before that, they're either to write a movie, find people that are willing to come to your house and be in it, or whoever you're shooting. Like, I shot one here, but, you know, come to your house and be in it, stay with it for a couple weekends, then find someone to edit it or edit it yourself. And that may take a couple months, you know, and then the post and the deliverables, finding a distributor. It's crazy. You have, and then to go out and promote your movies and, you know, get it in places. I mean, you're spending a year with something. So why would you intentionally make that bad? Because you have to, live with it. If you're really trying to get a movie out, not just make a movie, or it's, you have to live with it for a year. Every step of it is difficult. Every step of it is difficult. So why, you know, why start off making something bad? You know, you can make something fun, but people aren't trying to make bad movies. People may think they're bad, and that's, and you know, it's a scary thing. Cause I realize there's an old story. A friend of mine who hosted a old time movie show in Muncie, Indiana, where I grew up, his name was Conrad Lane. He's passed away since then. Very gentlemanly film scholar. And he told me once, he grew up in California and he was a usher at, you know, back when they had ushers at theaters. And there was a screening of Lou Costello's movie that he made by himself that bombed. I forget what it's called, but it was screening and Lou Costello was there. And Conrad Lane is a teenager and he sees Lou Costello walking out with just this fallen face. And that he did, and I always thought at the time when Conrad Lane told me that story, I thought, why didn't Lou Costello know the movie was bad when he was making it? But now I've been involved in some movies we didn't realize when we were making them, they were going to turn out a certain way. Everybody wants to be good. Nobody wants it to be bad. Sometimes they turn out bad. And this isn't me. This is anybody. Tom Cruise has made some bombs. I'm not saying it's exclusive to B movies, but sometimes you see a movie and you go, man, why didn't people know that was bad? Because sometimes you don't know until it's over. Until you see it, you don't know, because there's so many people that are going to put their thoughts in along the way. You know, an editor, a color grader, sound mix, music score. I mean, all these things that you aren't, you know, you may not be a part of. So it's interesting.
Yeah. Cause I know back when I first got started doing reviews in 2010, back then it's not so much now anymore, but when the independent films started taking off where, you know, I know a lot of films that were really, 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 really bad. But because the reviewer is friends with the filmmaker, they would say how great it is when in reality it stunk. You know,
well, I think sometimes people that are doing reviews, they also want to work in film. I mean, that was me, you know, way back. I worked on a site called Microcinema Scene and we reviewed films. And part of it is that you want to be around the world of it. And so sometimes people start that way. Another thing that I've done that others have done is screen movies for festivals or be a festival judge, you know, so that there's, I think sometimes that's the impetus for people. Now for me, if somebody gives me like a bad review, like they don't like my movie that I made, if it's something smart that they say, I put thank you, you know, because it's like, at least somebody gave this an intellectual chance. If they didn't like it, that's fine. But somebody puts, you know, your movie sucks balls, you know, you suck, everybody in this is stupid. That's not constructive. If someone says, well, this is why I didn't like it. And it's written out in paragraph form with capitalization and punctuation. And I'm like, okay, I appreciate you. Cause you know, somebody may read that and say, well, I can see why this guy didn't like it, but maybe I would. And so it doesn't bother me. Sometimes, especially Letterboxd, you can sometimes get some really intellectual reviews for some reason, more than IMDb or Amazon. You can get some intellectual reviews, and some of them, they don't like you. But if they'll write something intelligent, or if they can talk intelligently, then it doesn't bother me. But I think, to your point, though, I think reason why so many people get softballs pitched to them is because those people also want to break into the industry. And I was one of those people, you know? So I understand I understand the motivation for giving soft reviews, but I also think most people appreciate if it's at least constructive. If you start off the stupidest thing I've ever seen, it's not the stupidest thing. I mean, to be honest, I always say this. I mean, if you watch any of the Fast and the Furious movies or Transformer movies, G.I. Joe movies, even most Marvel movies, I mean, they're actually stupid. I mean, this
yeah.
the only difference between my kind of stupid and theirs is multi-millions of dollars, really. But correct. The actual it scripts aren't sense. That intelligent. They're not intelligent scripts. Right. And neither
it's more know, acceptable.
It's just acceptable. Yeah. You have better looking actors, smarter people, more money. Of course, you know, it's but people think automatically that B movies are stupid, and they're not stupid. They're just cheaper.
It's not even that. They think they're being made in people's backyards.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because people don't understand it, you know.
Yeah,
that's the way it is.
But you know, I think that I think the big thing is what you were talking about 15 years ago, you know, the entry points to things looking better is really getting the, I mean, when I worked in television, like back in the 90s, especially, I mean, we had the keys to the kingdom. No, there was no entry points. But there are now, especially with streaming, you know, and the, and, you know, shooting with iPhones and, you know, the technology is getting so much better. You know, the Polonia brothers, I think they will, I don't think enough has been made of the fact I mean, it's funny to talk about, but not enough seriousness has been brought to the fore about the fact that they shot a movie on Super VHS and sold it to Blockbuster. Not that the movie was great. It was shot on Super VHS and they sold it to Blockbuster. That's the story. Not that the movie had sock puppets in it, you know. It's that they shot on Super VHS. So, you know, if you're shooting with cameras now that aren't that different than what anyone else can shoot with. So I think the entry point is a lot easier than it was back when, you know, like what you're talking about. But
yeah.
All right. What other gems you got hidden away in there? I'm getting asked about movies I never get asked about.
I'm going to go up to 2018, The Girl in the Crawl Space, okay. The film that you directed.
So I've been wanting to direct for a long time. I worked in television forever, and probably around this time was really my second instance. Probably this is 16, 17 of maybe not wanting to, not being offered things I wanted to write, not being able to, not being asked to do very much, you know, and I was a pretty established screenwriter, but I wasn't getting a lot of asks. So I really wanted to break into directing. I had wanted to for a long time. So I wrote a script just for myself that I knew I could shoot at my own house, maybe use some friends. And then I would go to conventions like a lot of people do and sell my movie on a card table, you know, at a convention. And, you know, I was telling this to my friend Enrique Couto, who I had written five or six movies for. And he was like, you know what? I'll give you 5 days. And that's a lot. That was a big thing that he did, because he gave me 5 days of his time with his gear, and that's how it started. He goes, I'll give you 5 days to make this movie, and you know, and we'll partner up on it. So I had to put my money where my mouth was at that point. And as you can see, if you've seen it, I used a lot of people that I'd met through movies, and then behind the scenes I used students from the college I work at. I used some friends. But I shot pretty much 80% of that movie was shot in this house that I'm sitting in tonight. And oh, wow. And my goal, and then 20% was different places, very small cast and crew. And my real goal was to sell it from a card table. And, you know, maybe I wrote something exactly for myself, not what anyone else wanted me to do, not an Amityville movie or a Bigfoot movie or anything. It was my own. And I thought nobody's going to like this very much. This is all about my own interests and things. But no one was more surprised than anyone. I was shocked that ITN distribution picked it up, and it was all of a sudden it was in Walmart, Family Video, back when there was Family Video. It was all over the place. It was a very big shock to me. But it was probably the interesting thing that happened is I knew it was coming out in February, the date in February, and movies drop on a Tuesday back when we had video stores. Yeah. And I was in Chicago for work, but I knew that it was coming, and I was driving back on, it's about 5 hours from my house to Chicago. And I knew that it was dropping in Family Video the next day on Tuesday. So I looked on a map because you could look, find a family video store near you. So I looked at the map and I found probably 8 or 10 stores in Indiana that were kind of on my way home. Maybe a dozen, maybe not quite that, 8 or 10. So that Monday I drove from Chicago all the way over to my home and I stopped at 8, 10, 11 places and just went in and said, "Hey, I'm John Dalton. I'm an Indiana filmmaker. My movie's dropping tomorrow. I hope you guys stock it." I think almost universally everybody had it. And then it was kind of, you know, it surprised me. People wanted to take a picture with me in the store, sign the, and it was a really, really memorable thing. And that was, if you're doing your math correctly, you'll realize that was only a few weeks before the coming of the apocalypse. So yeah, my movie dropped in mid-February of 20. And then, you know, in March of 20, very early March of 20, I was sent home from work for 7 weeks and stayed home. I'm sorry, for 3 weeks. And I stayed home 17 months. So, yeah, that was the, but, and that movie has made its way all through channels and made its way to its, you know, its end of its natural life in Dollar Trees and on Tubi. So, but I'm very, very proud of it. I made it. I financed it myself out of my own pocket. I shot at my own house, used a lot of friends and people I'd gotten to know in the business. I called in a million favors and that's how it went. And it exceeded my expectations. So,
well, the next movie that we're going to talk about was a learning movie for, I did a podcast called Gruesome and Gore. So I had a 15-year-old that wanted to learn how to podcast. Yeah. Has no idea what independent film is. Go figure. They only know the high ones like you mentioned, Spider-Man and all this. Yeah. So I said, fine, you know what? Let's do a podcast together. And then I want to have you watch the movies with me. And I want to see what your opinion is. Scarecrow County 2019 was a film that we watched together. Now, as you know, I've seen tons of these films, budgeted films, my whole career. So I wanted to get his take on this. To my pleasant surprise, you had a 15-year-old loving your film.
Yeah, that's a nice surprise.
And I was like, wow, he gets it. He's a smart kid. He gets it. He knows it's not no zillion budget. He knows it's low budget, but he enjoyed it. So as you know, I released that review. It's actually on my YouTube channel right now. Mm-hmm. You can search it there if you want to listen to it again. But he loved it. And that really got him hooked into the independent film. So John Oak Dalton, thank you. You got to a 15-year-old that I was surprised that I didn't think he would take to it, but he really enjoyed it.
Well, that's awesome. I am, you know, what happened with that is the day that we sent all the deliverables in, I think it was the day we recorded the Enrique Couto and I recorded the commentary track for Girl in the Crawl Space. I think the funny thing is about at least the B movie industry is people are saying, well, what are you working on? What's next? What do you have next? Well, when we sent all that stuff, we didn't have anything next, but ITN had basically, well, what do you guys have next? Or what else are you working on? We weren't working on anything else. I was trying to make one movie to prove that I could make a movie. I wasn't planning on making more films at that time. I just wanted to make one movie because nobody was really wanting me to write any movies for them. So I wrote a movie for myself and made it. But so the day that we sent in all the deliverables, it was the day we recorded the commentary track for Girl in the Crawl Space. I was Enrique Couto and I were walking his dogs, his two rescue dogs, around his neighborhood in Dayton, Ohio. And he had told me, and Scott, I have a feeling you probably know about this old TV movie called Dark Knight of the Scarecrow. Remember that old TV movie? Well, I live way, Enrique lives in Dayton, Ohio, a city. He lives in a city area. I live in a rural area, and I own several acres out in the country, and there's farm fields all around me. And I remember Enrique had said to me, boy, this reminds me of Dark Knight of the Scarecrow. You know, because there's cornfields all around me and everything. Matter of fact, they're out there taking down soybeans right now while we're talking tonight. yeah, and there's a brown fog hanging over my whole house, actually. So we were walking his dogs, and we started talking about Dark Knight of the Scarecrow again. I said, you know, after you told me that, I went out and got the movie. I bought it, I think, off of Amazon and watching them, because I remember when it came on when I was like a kid, I think in the 70s. Maybe it's from the 80s. Yeah. I remember seeing it. So I watched it again, and I said, you know, if I was to do this movie today, I wouldn't make it a mentally disabled person. I'd make it a kid that was bullied for being gay, because that was a big, you know, that was more of a real issue, at least where I grew up.
Yes.
And that was more of an issue than, and, you know, and the movie kind of plays with the idea of how it's much more acceptable today than, you know, and all that. So it kind of play, and we just started talking about it and just kind of spitballing. Well, if you did that, what if this happened? And what if one of the characters has been closeted this entire time? Well, I knew, you know, growing up, there were, you know, friends of mine that were closeted that are out now. And, you know, we just started talking openly about it. And that day in January of 19, I went home and started writing. And we shot that movie in March of 19. And then in October, we screened it at a film, a Dusk to Dawn film festival in Iowa City. So that came about very, very quickly. And I think because it came about so quickly, I just kind of relied on everybody I used the first time. Because we had basically just finished Crawl Space and went right into production on Scarecrow County, literally as soon as we finished the next day. And so, and I kind of thought at the time, well, nobody's going to see these movies back to back. So, you know, it does, but I have found out since then a lot of people have watched them together. Even funnier than that, when I did Girl in the Crawl Space, I cast John Hambrick and Joni Durian as a married couple. And right before that, they had worked on a movie for Enrique called Ouija Room, where they play brother and sister. And I had said to Enrique, gosh, should I cast them as husband and wife if they just played brother and sister? And he was like, no one's going to pay attention to that, or it's not going to make any difference. Well, what ended up happening was, through a twist of fate, Ouija Room and Girl in the Crawl Space came out the same day. even though Ouija Room was shot before Crawl Space, they ended up coming out the same day. So on the same day, you could go to the store and there was John and Joni playing husband and wife, and there was John and Joni playing brother and sister, and a lot of the same people. Ia Boo Windermere, I think, was in both she was in both the movies. I think Joe Kidd was in both the movies. Aaron Ryan is in both the movies. So it was funny that they ended up coming out on the same exact day. Yeah, they dropped in Walmart the same day. And that was February of 20. And then in October of 20, while COVID was running free, that's when Scarecrow County came out, which, you know, it came out during a time when it was a little more difficult for people to get out and about. But and then we didn't do anything. I was a day away from shooting a new movie when I was sent on a Friday. We were sent home for 3 weeks. And I thought, boy, you know, I could get one weekend in, but I wonder if we'll get a second weekend in. And having half a movie is worse than no movie, because you have half a movie, right? Someday you've got to go back and match continuity and find the same people. And hopefully nobody spilled coffee on a piece of furniture and got rid of it, you know, and all of this. But I thought 3 weeks was going to be bad to try to match continuity, much less, as it turned out, a year and a half later. I'm glad I didn't start that movie. But I was in the same boat as a lot of people. We sort of didn't know what to do for a long time. So I wrote scripts for other people during that time. And then, you know, in December of this year, in September of this last year, ITN reached out and said, what are you guys working on? And sure enough, we were fortunately working on something and shot Smart House after that.
Yeah, that we're going to talk about. I haven't seen it yet, but I have it. There's a lot of shark movies being made, you know. Yep. I mean, everybody from Dustin Ferguson to Sci-Fi Channel to Mark Polonia.
Yep.
Amityville Island in 2020, you know. I'm assuming this movie probably was released by ITN.
No, I think that was Wild. I think this one was Wild Eye, but I can't.
Wild Eye.
I think it's Wild Eye.
Okay. Because Wild Eye and ITN seems to have a fascination with changing titles for movies and putting Amityville in it, which is fine, you know. But Amityville Island, I've not seen, but it looks appealing. Mark Polonia is the director. How did this story come about? Now, was this during the COVID?
No, actually, boy, I can't remember. I think, no, what happened was, so it's kind of funny. The first movie I ever did for Mark, that Among Us, that Bigfoot movie, I went out and helped. I was a production assistant on the movie because I was working in television video production at the time. So I just went out to help. I drove out to Elmira, New York area, very northern Pennsylvania, and worked on the movie. It's about a 13-hour drive from here, I think. And while I was out there, this is probably like maybe 2002 or three, somewhere in there. Sub Rosa put that movie out and they called while we were working on it and offered the Polonia brothers a 3-movie deal. And I remember Mark turning to me and saying, do you want to write 3 more movies this year? And I was like, I can't write 3 movies in a year. You know, I can't, that's too fast. I can't write that fast. This was very early on. And so, but I agreed to rewrite over 2 of their movies scripts because John Polonia had a whole box of handwritten scripts. He'd written out by hand. So when I say rewriting, I was putting them into a script writing software and sort of rewriting it hot as I was typing his scripts up, really.
Right.
And those 3 movies, it's a perfect encapsulation of how the B movie industry works. Because the first one was Peter Rottentail, which was a rewrite. And it's rated one of the worst movies of all time by tons of websites. I mean, Fangoria has done an hour-long podcast. You know, part of me is like, oh man, Fangoria crapped on it for an hour. But the other part of it is, hey, Fangoria talked about it for an hour. I mean, when I was a teenager, Fangoria was the lodestone of reviews, right? I mean, everybody wanted to read Fangoria. So what, first one was Peter Rottentail. Second one was Razor Teeth, a Piranha movie, which disappeared. No one ever spoke about it. No one ever reviewed. And then the third script never got made. So to me, that's a perfect encapsulation of the industry, right? One, everybody sees, but they think it stinks. One comes out, nobody sees, knows about. Third one never gets made. That's a perfect encapsulation. So fast forward now, like 15 years. All right. So now it's 15 years later or so. And I am working on a movie with Mark, and I'm out there again, and it's called Real Monsters, which is more of a PG type kid friendly movie, which the script turned out really good. And I'm out there working on that. And he was offered another 3 movie deal, and the titles were already made. They were Amityville Island, one with Sharks versus Aliens, which became Shark Encounters of the Third Kind. And the third one was called Jurassic Exorcist. And he turned to me and was like, can you write these? Oh, yeah, of course I can. Years later. Of course I can. When do you need them? And he was like, oh, I need them in 6 weeks. And I'm like, 3 movies in 6 weeks? Yeah, I'll do that. So it was more like I wanted to challenge myself because I never had written that fast. But I wrote all 3 of those movies back to back in 6 weeks. And I don't remember a lot of them. Jurassic Exorcist is, I believe, was made but didn't come out. So they all 3 got made. Sharks versus Aliens, which was the one I had the most trouble with. Just I couldn't get my mind around it. That became a Shark Encounters of the Third Kind. Amityville Island I had a lot of fun with, though. To your original question, Amityville Island, I had written a script for Mark a few years before, which was sort of, he really wanted to do a version of Zombie 2, kind of, you know, the Italian film. So I'd written this movie called Dr. Zombie, which was a straight up Italian zombie movie, just an Italian zombie movie recast. So I had the script, the movie didn't get made. And I said to him, well, can I just reuse Dr. Zombie and fix it up a little bit to make Amityville Island? Oh, yeah, we can do that. So that one was kind of easy because I did a rewrite over a script that I had. But I added 2 elements of 2 other films that I like. There's some stuff from Tomb of the Blind Dead, which I know Mark loves that movie. And also Lust for Freedom, which is a movie I like. So it's really Zombie 2, Tomb of the Blind Dead, and Lust for Freedom in a blender. So I had a lot of fun writing because I put all kinds of outrageous things in it. I mean, there's women like boxing for their freedom, and there's, you know, a Amityville creature that takes over like a bear, and then a shark. And then, I mean, it's just nuts. I just had a lot of fun, but I wrote like at like a hallucinatory pitch. Like I was writing at this crazy fever pitch. So it's very, I think it's very fun. Sharks versus Aliens. I think might be interesting for people that like Girl in the Crawl Space because a lot of my ideas I could see now were kind of forming. Because after I wrote these three, that's when I decided I would write my own movie, or maybe it was right around that. Because if you see Shark Encounters of the Third Kind now, you can kind of see, well, there's a therapist in it, and I used a therapist in Crawl Space. The sheriff in it likes Westerns, and I made one of the characters in Crawl Space like Westerns. And so I could sort of see that I was kind of very, like, for completists, I would say, only for completists, they should watch Shark Encounters of the Third Kind, because there's some things that I was germinating on now that I see that I put into Crawl Space. And then Jurassic Exorcist was my favorite of the three scripts, and it hasn't come out. Just like before, the third script that didn't come out was called Demons on a Dead End Street, and I thought it was great, and it never got made. But I think Jurassic Exorcist got made. It just has not come out, and I don't know if it will. It's been several years, but I wouldn't be surprised if it pops up one day. About a possessed dinosaur and a priest. I mean, the usual kind of thing. So
nice. Well, the next one I talked to you about earlier, I need to get it watched, is Noah's Shark.
Okay. Well, how could I not want to write something called Noah's Shark? You know, it's got elements of found footage in it. What I was really trying to do is riff a little bit on television and televangelism and found footage. And I think it's funny. I was hoping that a lot of Christians would get really mad, and then more people would want to watch it. And what really surprised me is that a bunch of Satanists didn't like it. And I thought that they would be my core audience, you know, some Satanists. But the Satanists of Twitter were really kind of raking me over the proverbial coals. And I was like, come on, Satanists. I was kind of thinking you guys would be on my side for once. And they really But what's funny is like some Christians gave it like a serious review, which I mean, I did actually put real things, but then other people that weren't really that up on Christianity, they were like, what's this Witch of Endor? Is that a Star Wars reference? No, there's a Witch of Endor in the Bible. Endor is not from Star Wars, you know? So it's a complicated movie for me because I really did work hard on it. And the other thing I did I think one of Mark's best movies that I wasn't involved in is called Amityville Exorcism. I think it's good. And my good friend, Jeff Kirkendall, who's a good friend of mine, plays Father Benna. When I wrote the script, I just put him in it. I made Father Benna the character. And since then, Mark himself put him in Amityville in Space. You're welcome, Internet, that happened. But he used Father Benna again. Yeah, so Father Benna's appeared in three movies now. But I wrote him into Noah's Shark because I liked Jeff Kirkendall. I like his acting, and I liked the character that he played. So I'm happy with it. I think people didn't get everything about it. I think Jeff's really funny in it. I think Ryan Dalton, who's not related to me despite what IMDb says, Ryan Dalton is really funny as the televangelist, I think. So I don't know. I'm happy with it. So I hope people check it out. But like I said, I thought there'd be more of a Christian uproar against it, and then more people would like it. And it didn't really happen the way I thought, but it's still out there if people want to get it.
Well, we're going to go to a Western. Okay. Jesse James Unchained.
Well, I love spaghetti Westerns, really, which is why sometimes Western themes pop up in some of my movies that I write, or just people liking Westerns or Western novels or spaghetti Westerns. I thought I was born too late to write one, but there's really a long tail in, you know what I mean by a long tail? Like there's a million people that want to see an X-Men movie, and then you start going down, and way out here are got, you know, as the curve goes down, there's people, a lot of people that want to see certain kind of movie. Then way out here, there's guys like me that's like, I'm going to watch every Western I can find that has Django in the title, you know, every Django movie I can find. I mean, that's called the long tail. It's this very shallow but intensely interested audience. And I think my entire career is in the long tail, you know, but there's a long tail for Western movies. And my dad is one of those people, you know, there's a people that just watch old fashioned Westerns. So I wrote one called Calamity Jane's Revenge, which I was really proud of. And I didn't make up a lot of the details. Yeah, there were people, the people and characters I talked about were real. And same with Jesse James. I thought I picked up this little bit of his life where he had basically tried to go straight, kind of, he and his brother Frank, and they went to Tennessee. And then this, that, the other, there was a false Jesse James gang using their name. That was all real. So when I wrote Jesse James Unchained, I based it on, you know, on real things that were happening. And, you know, nice. I think both the Westerns I did with Enrique Cuto turned out good, but that's probably my favorite of the two. I was there on the set on both of those as well. But if you've got a dad that likes Westerns, they're both good old fashioned Westerns. They're not, you know, they don't pretend to be something else.
And listeners, most of the movies that we're talking about is available on YouTube to watch.
Yes, or Tubi.
Or Tubi. Yeah. Now, there's a movie that I have not seen. I know I posted a poster in my Gruesome Herzog Facebook page, Smart House.
Okay.
Am staying watched by this weekend.
Oh, excellent. I
watched another movie. I can't remember what it's called. I did a couple months ago. It's about a smart house as well. Can't remember what it's called. But I'm intrigued because John Oak Dalton wrote it and directed it along with Luca Nicolix and Richard Pierce.
Yeah.
Now, I saw you post stuff about this. So I said, you know, let's check it out. It's an online influencer is trapped in a smart home by a sinister hacker and forced to start a strange live stream while her family and friends fight to get her free.
Mm-hmm. Well, this might be a good, this might be a good one for us to end on, since this is my most recent thing that just came out about a week ago. It just dropped on streaming about a week ago. So this might be a good. So many, many years ago, a young man, this is my story I tell people when I say it never hurts to be nice to people, because you never know. It's such a long game, you know, you never know who's going to have a break in the industry. So many, many years ago, this Richard Pierce used to write to me, and I think he was either in high school or college, just, hey, how did you break into the industry? And I like your B movies you've written. And he's a Polonia Brothers fan. And he and I have just written on the internet, you know, and been Facebook friends and everything all these years. Well, a few years ago, Richard got a break and sold a movie to Lifetime. And then he sold, you know, several movies to Lifetime. And then pretty soon he's, you know, moving part-time to his day job to keep writing movies for Lifetime. He's doing pretty well. Yeah. And, you know, he and I have been chatting all these years, and he reached out to me and said, hey, I'd like to work on a script with you. I'm like, well, you're doing a lot better than me. You don't need to work on a script with me. But I think he just was, you know, he just wanted to work on a B movie together. And he had pitched this smart house idea to Lifetime. They passed on it. And he kind of pitched it to me, and I was like, oh, I could kind of see this. So he and I started working on it. And then when ITN reached out, are you guys working on something? Yes, we are. And so that one went into production really quickly, and Richard flew out with his family. As it turns out, Richard Pierce, a native of Las Vegas, Nevada, is a big Garfield fan. And people may or may not know that Garfield is from my hometown of Muncie, Indiana, where a lot of this movie was shot. So,
oh, really?
Yes. And my greatest One of my great claims of infamy, not fame, is when I was in high school in the very early 80s, my art teacher, I was a cartoonist too, and my art teacher knew Jim Davis and was like, oh, you know, Jim Davis would like a kid to come out and, you know, help around the studio. Like, you know, I'm like, I'm not going to go take out the trash at some guy's studio. You know, I'd be a millionaire today, right? If I had just gone to take out the trash at Jim Davis's studio in the early 1980s, but I did not. Because I was a fan, and maybe you know this, Scott, or not. I was a fan of T.K. Ryan, who did the comic strip Tumbleweeds. Remember that comic strip?
Yep.
Yeah. I have a feeling we're in the same, generation.
Yep. I'm 2 years younger. I was born in 68, so.
I was born in 66, so we are the same.
Yes, sir. We're in the same era, yeah.
And T.K. Ryan also lived in Muncie, my hometown. And I had written a fan letter to T.K. Ryan that he had answered. That was my most treasured possession. So I wanted to go be a cartoonist with T.K. Ryan, not with Jim Davis. Well, nobody remembers T.K. Ryan now, but everybody knows about Jim Davis.
So, go figure.
Go. So I guessed wrong there. But anyway, Richard Pearson and his family came to Muncie, and his daughter and his wife toured around and looked at Garfield stuff and had a big time. And Richard came and worked on the movie. Half of that was shot at my son's house, actually, in Muncie, and then the other half was shot over in Dayton. And it has... I just reached out to, you know, I wanted to work with Ibu Windermere and Joe Kidd, who I've mentioned. They'd had small parts in my other movies. And I really wanted to do a movie with them. So they star in the movie. And, you know, my good friend Tom Cherry, that I can't make a movie without, he played the dad, Brownie, in Scarecrow County. He plays the hacker dad in this movie. And I think my biggest coup was I got Brink Stevens in the movie as the AI voice. And my friend Enrique Couto had done a video project, a TV project with her. And so he made the connection for me. And I was really flattered that she liked the script and did the voice. And she knocks it out. So, you know, if we're the same age, you know about Brink Stevens. And
yes,
you know, yep. What a tremendous. I met Brink Stevens. Oh, you have?
Yeah, I met her in San Diego at a film festival. I'm a producer of the Fantastic Horror Film Festival. I met her 1 year.
Well, I tell you the truth, Scott, when I got on the phone with her, I was pretty dry mouth. That's the first time I've really, really been nervous talking to somebody seriously. Because as soon as I heard her voice, I mean, you know who it is, right? So,
yep.
Yeah, so it's out now, and I hope people check it out. And, Scott, I hope you get a chance to see it sometime soon.
I will be this week. I know there's a bunch of the films that we talked about. They're in my lineup to watch. So don't be surprised if you see like four of your films in a row getting reviewed.
That sounds great. Right, I appreciate it. And just be honest, I don't mind.
Nah, yeah. I mean, if I don't like something, I don't review it. That's how I've always been for the last 13 years.
You know, it's funny that you say that because I'm the same way with I've kept a book review blog for a long time where I try to read 50 books a year, and I try different. Some I'm 1 year I may read all people of color, 1 year people in translation, you know, all women authors. You know, sometimes I just mix it up. But I'm kind of the, you know, if I don't like something, I don't finish it. And so then I don't write about it. So people say, well, you liked all the books you read. Right. Well, it's because I read them all the way to the end. That's why I liked it. If I didn't like it, I would have put it down after 50 pages. So I understand the sentiment.
Yeah, that was said to me one time. He goes, it seems like you like every movie. I said, you have no idea. Because there's something I don't like, I don't reveal. It's not... My job as a reviewer, yes, to review people's movies, yes, but it's not my job to deter people away from a movie that I might not just, I don't like, that somebody else will like. Yeah. You know, that's been my motto. I'm not trying to be Howard Stern of the horror review business. That's not who I am. If I like something, I review it. That's awesome. Story. If I don't like it, I don't review it. Because it's not my place. Yeah. You know, we all have different tastes.
Yeah, and I think sometimes, even if somebody says a bad review, somebody can watch and say, well, I don't, that guy, it sounds like something I would actually like, you know, so it doesn't bother me that much if people have a bad review, because somebody could watch that and say, well, that didn't seem fair, I think I would have liked that, so, gosh, Scott, I think you've mined deeper than anybody I've ever been on a podcast with. I've liked it. It's been awesome. I appreciate it so much. I hope you invite me back sometime.
I sure will. We definitely will. John, thanks for coming on. I really appreciate your time. Thank you. It's great to talk to you. And I will let you know when my this gets done, and I'll also, you'll just look out for the movies that I'm going to review, and I'll post them on your page, and then we can go from there.
Awesome. Thank you.